She tore a whole file cabinet apart where she kept correspondence, and it wasn't there. She knew she had kept it, out of sentiment, but had no idea where she'd put it. Obviously in some unusual place. It was a Christmas card from their old nanny, who had come to work for the Pearsons when Winnie was 2 years before Valerie was born, and had stayed until Valerie was 10, a span of 12 years. Fiona had been a young Irish girl of 18 when she came to work for them, which made her 94 now. She had married and moved to New Hampshire, where she was in a nursing home, but her mind was still clear. Her handwriting on the Christmas card was shaky, but she was still lucid despite her age. Valerie hadn't visited her in nearly 20 years, since Philip was 15, although they stayed in touch and Valerie wrote to her. She had loved her passionately and been devastated when she left, and Fiona sent her Christmas cards every year. Valerie just hoped she hadn't died since the previous Christmas, but she thought her children would have let her know. It was 2 in the morning when Valerie found the card, along with some others she had saved and put in her desk drawer. It was the last place she had looked. She had kept the envelope, too, with the address of the nursing home. She was in southern New Hampshire, where she had lived for more than 60 years. It was a 6-hour drive from New York. Valerie lay awake in her bed all night after she found the card, and she called the nursing home at 8 in the morning. They told her that Fiona McCarthy was very much alive and doing well. They said she was bedridden now from her arthritis, but she was clear as a bell and still feisty, the nurse who answered said, laughing. She keeps us on our toes. An hour later, Valerie was at the garage where she kept the car she owned, but seldom used. She liked to have it if she ever needed it, and talked about selling it occasionally. She was on the road by 9:15, and crossed through Connecticut and Massachusetts, and into New Hampshire. There was still snow on the ground, although it was March, but there was very little, and there was no sign of spring yet. It was almost 3 o'clock when she reached the tiny town that had been Fiona's home for so many years. And the nursing home looked warm and inviting. It was white and freshly painted, with a picket fence around it, a front garden, and rocking chairs on the porch the residents used in warm weather, but it was still too cold at this time of year. Valerie walked up the front steps with trepidation, wondering if Fiona would remember her, or even recognize her, and what would she say about the photographs? Valerie was an old woman now, and looked very different than Fiona's memories of her, even after 20 years. She spoke to a nurse's aide at the front desk, who smiled and asked her to sign in, which she did. She said that Fiona had just woken up from a nap, and it was a good time to visit. She said her children had been there that morning, and she was alone, and would enjoy the visit. Valerie thanked her and walked to the room. She peeked in and saw a wizened old woman with a face full of wrinkles tucked into the bed, with a bright handmade quilt on it. Her hair was wispy and white, but her eyes were the same. They were a brilliant blue that burned right through Valerie as the old woman looked at her. She smiled as Valerie stood in the doorway.
"Are you going to stand there like a statue forever, or come in?"
she said, grinning. She knew instantly who Valerie was.
"Hello, Fiona. I don't know if you know who I am,"
she started to explain, and Fiona laughed.
"And why wouldn't I? You haven't changed except for the blonde hair going white. How's your boy?"
She remembered Philip. Her mind really was clear. Philip had loved her when they met, and she had told him tales of his mother that made him laugh and brought tears of memory to Valerie's eyes.
"All grown up," Valerie answered. "He's a good man." "He was a fine boy when I met him."
She pointed to a chair, and Valerie sat down, wondering where to start after all this time, but Fiona did it for her.
"You took a long time getting here. I've been waiting for so many years,"
she said cryptically.
"I thought maybe after your last visit you'd come back with some questions, but you didn't. Why now?"
She looked interested in what Valerie had to say, and she was wide awake and alert.
"Some strange things have happened. None of it may mean anything, but it's been driving me crazy. Some photographs have turned up in an unclaimed estate my son has been working on, and there's a coincidence of name. The woman who left the estate had the maiden name of Pearson, and the same first name as my sister, the one who died, Marguerite. We're probably not related, but there are some photographs of a child..."
Her voice drifted off as Fiona watched her intently.
Winnie says I'm insane, and maybe I am, but I thought you would know.
Valerie delved into her handbag then and brought out the photographs of Marguerite before she showed her the ones of the little girl with no name.
I've come up with some very odd theories in the past few days. Maybe there's no connection with this woman, but there are no pictures of my sister. My mother destroyed them all. Winnie and I don't know what she looked like.
She handed the photographs to Fiona, who examined them through her bifocals one by one, and nodded as Valerie held her breath. Her whole body was trembling, as though something terrible was about to happen, or maybe something very good that would set her on a path to freedom from a family that had never understood nor wanted her. All her life she had felt obligated to them, and had been respectful, while they had reciprocated none of it. Fiona finished going through the pictures, and looked at her with a solemn expression.
What do you want to know? I know it sounds crazy, Valerie said in barely more than a whisper. But is that woman my sister Marguerite, who died in Europe at 19?
Fiona didn't hesitate before she answered, and she looked certain.
No, it isn't.
Valerie's heart sank at the words. She had hoped it was. Fiona reached out a gnarled hand then, and patted Valerie's hand with a tender look.
The woman in the photographs is not your sister. She's your mother, she said gently. Marguerite was your mother, child.
Valerie felt like one as she listened in sudden shock.
And she didn't die in Europe. She got married. When I was born?
Suddenly it was all so confusing, and everything had been a lie, just as she had thought, and Winnie denied. But this was even more complicated than she could have imagined.
You were born before she left. She was 18. I always thought they would tell you one day, but they never did. She was just a girl, and madly in love with a boy called Tommy Babcock, and the worst happened. She got pregnant. They wanted to get married, and her parents wouldn't let them, and neither would his. The poor things were like Romeo and Juliet. Your mother,
Fiona corrected herself,
her mother, said she would never forgive her for the disgrace. A few days later, they shipped her off to a home for wayward girls in Maine. It was right before Thanksgiving in 1941. She was just 17, and Tommy was the same age, but turning 18. I don't think anyone knew about what had happened, and in those days pregnancy was such a disgrace. They sent her off very quickly, and told everyone they were sending her to finishing school in Europe for a year. In Switzerland, I think. The war had already started in Europe, but Switzerland was safe. But she wasn't there. She was in Maine, writing me letters about how miserable she was. Winnie was only 4 then, and didn't know what was going on, but she cried when Marguerite left. Marguerite was such a sunny little thing. Everyone loved her. The house became a tomb without her, and her mother had murder in her eyes. Her mother was going to put the baby up for adoption. They were forcing her to give it up. She had been there about 2 weeks when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and everyone was in a panic. And the next thing I heard, Tommy had been drafted and was in boot camp in New Jersey. I think he was sent to California right before Christmas. I don't know if Marguerite ever saw him again. I doubt it. But I don't know that for sure. Maybe he went to Maine to say goodbye. And if he did, he probably promised he'd be back for her. I think he'd been in California for a month when he was killed in a training accident. Marguerite wrote to me that he was dead at the end of January. Your mother had a strong will and a strong mind, and after he died, I think she told her parents she wouldn't give up his child. The next thing I knew, your mother, or grandmother, told everyone she was expecting, and they were going to the country so she could rest. They rented a house in Bangor, Maine, and I used to visit your mother at the home for girls. The poor thing was heartbroken over Tommy. Your grandparents had agreed not to put the baby up for adoption, and to say it was theirs. You were born in June, a big, beautiful baby, and your mother had a hard time of it. She was so young. We spent the summer in Maine, and in September we went back to New York, your grandparents, as they were rightfully, with their new baby. And 2 weeks after we got back to New York, they sent Marguerite away, and they claimed you as their own. I've never seen anyone cry in my life like your mother the night before she sailed for Europe. They booked her passage on a Swedish ship called the Gripsholm. It was sailing to Lisbon with other civilians on it because Portugal wasn't in the war, and she was planning to go to England after they docked. They sent her to Europe with a war on. The ship could have been torpedoed, and they didn't care.
Tears ran down Fiona's cheeks as she told this story.
I went to see her off. They gave her no choice. They wanted her gone. She held you all night, the night before she left. And she swore she'd come back for you one day. And in the morning, she left. I promised to send her pictures of you whenever I could, and I did, for as long as I was there. Your parents never wanted her to come back. She told me they were going to make her stay in Europe, even with the war on. She met the Count very quickly after she got to England. I don't remember, but she might have met him on the trip over. She said he was a kind man and wonderful to her, but she always missed you and said her life wasn't complete without you. She was meant to stay in England when she got there, but she went to Italy with him instead. He got her into the country with an Italian passport after he married her in London. I know she tried to get you back at one point. I think you were about 7. She came for 2 weeks with her husband to see lawyers about taking you to Italy with them. The war was over. She met with your grandparents, and she told me they wouldn't give you up. I'm not sure what they did to convince her, but she and her husband left without you. I never saw her again after that. Your grandmother was livid and threatened to expose Marguerite, disgrace her, and cause a scandal. I think she and her husband tried to get you back through the courts after that, but it didn't work, and she eventually gave up. Her parents fought too hard. Your grandmother never had any maternal feelings for you, and she left you to me to take care of, but they were trapped in a lie, and the story they had made up, that you were their child, and they wouldn't return you to your rightful mother. They had forced her to let them adopt you. Marguerite never had any other children. She didn't want any. All she wanted was you, and they kept you from her. It was cruel, but at least she had a kind husband who doted on her and took care of her. She was still young when he died, but she stayed in Italy afterward. She had nothing here. Your grandparents saw to that.
Fiona looked angry as she said it.
She never wanted to see her parents again. They didn't want to see her either. Once she left the following year, they told a story that she had died of influenza in Europe. She was 19 then, and they put a black wreath on the door. I would have been heartbroken, except she wrote to me. She was very much alive, and she didn't know what they'd said until I told her. They wanted to be sure she could never come back. I heard your grandmother tell your grandfather they had destroyed all her photographs. It was unnatural. Decent people don't do things like that. They stole you from her and buried their own daughter alive in everyone's mind. I could never think of them as your parents, and they didn't act like parents to you. They treated you like a stranger someone had left on their doorstep. I always hoped they would tell you one day about your mother and what they'd done, but they didn't. And no one else ever knew, except the doctors at the home in Maine and their lawyers. You had a proper birth certificate that named them as your parents. I saw it once. It was all a lie, and they broke their own daughter's heart. I was very glad she met the Count and he loved her so much, or she would have been alone in the world. She loved you, Valerie, very dearly, and she would never have left you if she had a choice. She's not still alive, is she?
Fiona wanted to know now, as Valerie shook her head with tears running down her cheeks. Now she knew for sure.
She died 7 months ago. She'd been back in New York for 22 years. I could have met her if I'd known.
It shocked her, too, to realize that Fiona was only 2 years older than her mother and was still alive. Her mother hadn't been as lucky, but had had a hard life and didn't have loving children to care for her like Fiona did.
I'm sure she would have looked for you if she'd dared.
Valerie couldn't help wondering why she hadn't, or maybe it was too painful to explain her return from the dead.
You were a grown woman. She must have thought it was too late.
Valerie would have loved to meet her real mother at any age, and it was shocking now to realize that she'd been right about all of it, that her grandparents masquerading as her parents had hated and resented her, and probably thought of her as a constant reminder of her mother's shame. And they had kept her mother away from her for an entire lifetime, until her mother's death, long after their own. The only mother love Valerie had ever known had been from Fiona until she was 10, and she looked gratefully at her now.
Thank you for telling me the truth,
Valerie said in a hushed tone.
I always wanted to. I thought you would suspect something or find out in some way. I never expected it to take this long.
It had taken 74 years to find out who her mother was, and she suddenly felt like the orphan she had been all her life. But at least she knew now that her mother had loved her. She was shaken, too, to realize that it was only a strange quirk of fate that had brought Philip into the appraisal of the abandoned safe deposit box. Otherwise, she would never have known. She was grateful for all of it now.
Tommy's parents were Muriel and Fred Babcock, by the way, if you ever want to look for them. I hear you can find people on the Internet. My son tried to give me a computer, but I'm too old to learn. But they're your family, too.
It hadn't even occurred to Valerie to do that, and she wanted to think about it. She had so much to absorb and try to understand first. She had just gained a mother who loved her and lost her, all in the same day. Fiona was tired after the long story she'd told Valerie, which had taken 2 hours with all the details.
I'm ready for a nap,
she said as she closed her eyes, and Valerie leaned over and gently kissed her cheek. Her eyes fluttered open, and she smiled.
Thank you, Fiona. I love you,
she said, just as she had as a child.
I love you, too,
Fiona said, patting her hand again.
Just know that she loved you, and she's an angel watching over you now.
It was a sweet thought, and Valerie tiptoed out of the room as Fiona fell asleep. It had been the most emotional day of Valerie's life. Valerie got back in her car then, and thinking of everything Fiona had said, she drove back to New York. She stopped for coffee once at a truck stop on the way, and sat staring into space, thinking of her mother and everything that had happened to her, and the terrible parents she'd had. They had done all they could to ruin their eldest child's life as punishment for a youthful mistake and an illegitimate child. It made Valerie furious thinking of it, and as the anger subsided, she was overwhelmingly sad and filled with compassion for the mother she had never known, who had wanted to come back to her and never did. She got back to New York at midnight and lay awake for most of the night. She had a lot to think about. She had no idea what to do now. She wasn't ready to tell Philip yet, although she planned to, but first she had to make peace with it herself, with all its implications and ramifications. She wasn't who she thought she'd been all her life. The only one she wanted to tell was Winnie, to vindicate herself. She wasn't crazy after all, and she had never felt saner or clearer in her life. She propped a photograph of Marguerite on her night table as she got into bed. She had finally found the mother she'd never had.
Good night, Mama,
Valerie said softly, and drifted off into a deep sleep. Chapter 10. All Valerie knew when she woke up the next morning was that she had to take what had happened one step at a time. A bomb had hit her life the day before, and she wanted to control the damage as much as possible. She was planning to move slowly and think it all out carefully before she did. The one thing she knew was that Fiona had given her an incredible gift, the truth about herself, It explained so much why she had always felt like a stranger in their midst, and she had been her parents' grandchild, not their child. It made a big difference to her now, and the only person she wanted to tell at this early stage was her sister Winnie. Everything and everyone else could wait, even her son. She didn't want to share the story with him yet. She needed to try to understand it first. She called Winnie again that morning and told her she was going to drop by shortly. She didn't ask her this time, and she didn't care if it was convenient or not. What she wanted to say had waited 74 years, and she didn't want to wait any longer. Winnie was fully dressed in a navy blue Chanel suit when Valerie arrived, and she'd had her hair done the day before. She looked like the wealthy, aristocratic Park Avenue matron she was. Valerie was wearing jeans, a sweater, and ballet flats, and her snow-white hair in a braid down her back. Her eyes were bright, and she looked rested. She felt better than she had in years, and suddenly free of the burdens and disappointments of the past.
"I won't take long," Valerie said calmly as she sat down, and Winnie looked instantly worried. She had a feeling she wouldn't like whatever it was that Valerie was going to say. She was much too calm, and she was almost euphoric.
"Did something happen?"
"Yes," Valerie answered. "I visited Fiona yesterday, our old nanny."
"She's still alive?"
Winnie looked surprised. She had never corresponded with her or stayed in touch. Only Valerie had, and Fiona with her Christmas cards to her every year.
"She is."
"She must be 100 years old,
Winnie said, dismissing her.
94, and clear as a bell. I drove to New Hampshire to see her. I figured she might have the answers that you and I don't. We were too young when Marguerite left, and I was right. I didn't get the answers I expected. I showed her a photograph, and I thought she was going to tell me that Marguerite Pearson de Sampignelli was our sister. I was dead certain of it, but I was wrong."
Winnie ruffled up her feathers and looked self-satisfied and triumphant as Valerie admitted her mistake.
"I told you she wasn't. You were just trying to make trouble for Mother and Dad."
"All I wanted was the truth," Valerie said quietly, "no matter what it was, and that's what I got. The woman who left the safe deposit box full of jewels and was married to the Italian Count was in fact your sister, but not mine. She was my mother,"
Valerie said softly, with tears in her eyes.
"She got pregnant at 17 by a boy she was in love with. They wanted to get married, and their parents wouldn't let them. They separated them immediately. And your parents, my grandparents, sent Marguerite to a home for wayward girls in Maine and told her she had to give up the baby for adoption. They gave her no other choice, since it was considered scandalous to have a child out of wedlock at the time."
Winnie's eyes had opened wide, and she looked shocked by what Valerie was saying, but she said not a word, which made Valerie wonder if she had suspected it. But there was no way she could have known.
"That was November 1941, and 2 weeks later, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and the boy who was my father was drafted or enlisted in the army and went to boot camp. He was sent to California for further training, and he was killed in a matter of weeks in a training accident. And apparently my mother refused to give the baby up after that. So your mother and father, not mine,"
Valerie said pointedly again,
"moved to Maine, pretending that your mother was pregnant. They returned to New York in September, claiming me as their own child. They forced Marguerite to let them adopt me. And days later, they put Marguerite on a ship to Europe with a war on, banished from their home, and risked her life on a ship to Lisbon. And from there she went to England. Essentially, they forced her to give me up to them, even though they didn't like me or want me or approve of me. And a year after she left, they told everyone that Marguerite was dead, depriving me of my mother and her of her child. They kept me as their own child to avoid any scandal and broke her heart, and then pretended to all of us she was dead. Apparently she married very shortly after she got to London to a man who loved her dearly, thank God. Fiona says she tried to get me back, but they fought her tooth and nail and threatened her with scandal, and she eventually gave up. She never had other children, and I never had a mother who loved me, thanks to them. You may think they were good people, but I don't. They perpetuated a terrible lie for most of my life, and all evidence points to the fact that my mother, your older sister, led a lonely life once she was widowed at 41, and for the next 50 years I could have known her and loved her if I'd known she was alive. Your parents, my grandparents, robbed you of a sister, me of a mother, and her of her only child. I haven't digested it yet, and I don't know what I'm going to do about it. There's nothing I can't do. No one can undo what's been done and what they did. But I wanted you to know before anyone else. I'm not crazy or senile or delusional, as you suggested. I was right, more so than I ever knew. I thought Marguerite de Sampignelli was our sister. I never suspected for an instant that she was my mother. And whatever happens, I thought you should know. I can't imagine ever forgiving them for what they did. We were both innocent victims, you and I. We were lied to all our lives.
Valerie fell silent and looked at Winnie, who must have believed her. No sound came out of her mouth, and there were tears rolling down her cheeks. It still didn't seem possible to her, but everything Valerie said was so clear and so cohesive that however much Winnie hated it, it had the ring of truth. And as she listened, all her illusions about their family were shattered. Just as Valerie had said. Winnie was shocked, and she felt her safe, orderly little world crumbling around her. It was hard to imagine how Valerie felt, having never met the mother she had lost.
"I think they did love you, though,"
Winnie insisted in a hoarse, shaking voice, as Valerie looked at her stone-faced.
"They probably thought they were doing it for the best."
She was always loyal to them, even now.
They ruined my mother's life, your sister, and made my childhood a living hell. Fiona was the only loving adult in my life, and God knows how my mother must have felt, being robbed of her only child. It doesn't bear thinking, and she died alone, while you and I went on with our lives.
It was a horrifying thought, and Winnie continued to cry silent tears as the two women faced each other, and Valerie stood up.
"I'm sorry I sound so harsh about it. I just wanted you to know."
Winnie nodded, but made no move toward her. She wasn't sure if Valerie was angry at her by association or not, and she looked afraid. Valerie hugged her on the way out and turned at the front door with a wry smile.
"And by the way,"
she said with an ironic look at her very proper sister,
"you're not my sister anymore. You're my aunt."
She laughed and softly closed the door, and then she went back to her own apartment in Soho to decide what to do next. The whole configuration of her life had shifted in the past 20 hours. The map of her world would never be the same again. Chapter 11 Jane had been thinking of moving out all week. She knew the relationship had gone from bad to worse in recent months and appeared to be unsalvageable. John was in the Hamptons again this weekend, and she was going to tell him when he got home later that night. She had been packing all day, and a truck was coming for her boxes on Monday to put into storage. She was moving in with Alex for a few weeks until she found her own place. She hadn't told her parents yet. She was embarrassed to admit that she was breaking up with John. She had finished packing the cartons of books, papers, memorabilia, and sports equipment, and was about to start packing her clothes when John got home. The weather had been nice all weekend, and he'd gotten some sun lying on the beach, even though it was cold. He looked relaxed. It still shocked her that he had left her to fend for herself every weekend and was hanging out with his friends. Even if they were studying, they managed to have fun and had a barbecue the night before. It was a huge slap in the face. But she had finally realized that there was no point fighting the inevitable. It was over. She couldn't hide from it anymore. He looked startled when he saw the boxes in the front hall.
"What's all this?"
"My stuff. I'm moving out," she said simply, avoiding his eyes.
"Just like that? We don't discuss it?"
He didn't seem sad or upset, just annoyed.
"You didn't discuss it with me when you rented the house in the Hamptons with your pals. You haven't invited me out there once."
She looked hurt as she said it.
"We study all weekend. No one brings their partners out there. It's just us guys."
He looked innocent as he explained.
Kara and Michelle are not guys, she said coldly, to mask the hurt she felt. He had turned out to be a huge disappointment and a waste of 3 years of her life.
They're in my study group, he said, and moved to put his arms around her. What's the big deal?
I never see you anymore. We have no life together. Our relationship is a disaster. It's over. It's been over for months. Tears stung her eyes as she said it, but she refused to cry and looked pathetic to him.
You can't sit it out till June.
He went to the fridge, helped himself to a beer, and stared at her.
And then what? This isn't working anymore. We used to like each other. We did things together.
She had the feeling that they weren't talking about the real issues.
Are you sleeping with Kara?
They were back to that again, but now she wanted to know. School was no longer an adequate excuse for the disintegration of their relationship in the last 6 months. There was nothing left.
Oh, for Christ's sake! Are you cheating on me? Is that it? Are you projecting?
He was very clever at deflecting and not responding, and she got angry as she watched him. He wasn't even upset.
Answer the question, she said harshly. Sorry, counselor. Maybe it's none of your business what I'm doing if you're moving out.
He was being an asshole again and playing with her. It was a game of cat and mouse.
Do you care about this relationship?
She asked him bluntly.
Of course I do, but I can't sit here with you all day and night while I'm trying to graduate. You don't need to study in the Hamptons every weekend, or I could come with you sometimes.
It was obvious he didn't want that, and she suspected why. Someone was texting him frantically while they were talking, and she could guess who. She grabbed his cell phone off the table while he took a sip of beer, and her heart stopped when she read it. It was too late for him to stop her. The message read, "Is the bitch home? Can I come over?" And it was signed C. Jane had her answer. He looked shocked and pulled his phone out of her hand.
"What's that about?" Jane asked in an icy tone. "Mind your own fucking business," he said, stormed into the bedroom and slammed the door.
She went back to packing her clothes from the hall closet, and he came out of the bedroom a few minutes later. She was shaking, but he couldn't see it.
"Look, we're both under a lot of pressure. Things get crazy sometimes. Whatever happens with her doesn't mean anything. You and I have been together for 3 years. You seem to have forgotten that. I'm leaving. This isn't good for either of us. It hasn't been for months."
She turned to face him then.
"I thought we were honest with each other and faithful. Apparently I was wrong." "So who are you doing? The Christie's guy? You seem to like him a lot." "Yes, I do. And I'm not doing him. I told him about you. I don't do people. I live with you, and I thought we loved each other. Whatever that means to you." "I'm moving back to L.A.," he said, looking sheepish. "She's going back, too. I know you want to stay here and get a job with a fancy New York firm."
He was finally being honest with her. Way too late.
"So you just cheat on me and get your next romance going? That's how you tell me? I've had a great opportunity. Her father is going to give us seed money to start a business. It's a startup. This could be a big deal for me." "Great. It would have been nice if you ended it with me first. Why keep up the charade? Why bother? What's wrong with you?"
What he had done was hopelessly sloppy. She had been sitting at home, waiting for him, while he slept with Kara, and her father gave them money for a business.
"We don't want the same things," he said, sounding lame. "I thought we did. My mistake. You should have explained it to me when you figured it out. And Kara does want the same things? We're both from L.A. It was her idea to go back."
"Terrific,"
Jane said, as tears stung her eyes while she packed. She didn't want to look at him.
"You're from Michigan. That's different."
He thought he was cool, and instead he was just a jerk. He had completely changed, or finally exposed, who he'd always been. It no longer mattered which.
"Yeah, we're stupid, boring people who tell the truth. That must have sucked for you."
"You're too wholesome for me," he said honestly. "Kara is a dirty girl. That's who I am right now."
He sounded proud of it, and he had gone from denying that he was sleeping with her to tacitly admitting it and bragging about it. Whoever you are, or think you've become, why don't you just let me pack in peace? I'll stay somewhere else tonight, and you can tell her the bitch is gone.
Come on, babe, don't be like that. Let's not end it like this after 3 years.
You already did, she said quietly, went into the bedroom, took out her suitcases, and dumped whatever was left into them. All she wanted to do now was get out. She felt ridiculous being there while he told her she was too wholesome and made fun of her. She felt as though he had ripped her heart out through her throat. And he had obviously been cheating on her for months and laughing at her. She had been a total fool. It was hard to remember what she'd ever loved about him while she listened to him now. He sat on the couch drinking beer and watching TV while she packed the rest of her things. Half an hour later, there were 4 suitcases in the hall full of her clothes. The rest was in the boxes she had packed that afternoon that she was going to send to storage until she got her own place. She was leaving him everything she'd bought for the kitchen, and didn't care. Kara could use it if she cooked for him. Her skills seemed more appropriate to the bedroom than the kitchen. Jane put her coat on and picked up one of her bags. The apartment already looked barren. She could see that he was half drunk, and he looked stunned.
"That's it? You're really leaving?"
"Yes, I am."
"What happened to talking about it and working it out?"
"You can work it out with Kara. I heard enough."
And what was the point if he was moving back to L.A. with her? Jane pulled open the door to the apartment then and carried her bags into the hall. He got up to help, and she put up a hand.
"Don't. I can do it myself."
"Like everything else, you do so perfectly. Not everyone is as smart as you are with your perfect grades and scores. Life hands everything to you. Some of us have to hustle for it. You never do."
She realized then that he was jealous of her, and maybe always had been. There was no love in his eyes when he looked at her, and hadn't been in months. She understood it now, and Kara was part of the hustle for him. She would help him set up a business, and her father would pay for it. Jane had nothing like that to offer him. So they were through.
"Good luck in L.A.
The bags were heavy for her, but she didn't want his help. It disgusted her to look at him. She got all 4 bags into the hall, and from there into the elevator, and then went back into the apartment.
"I'm having someone pick my boxes up tomorrow, and then I'll send you the keys. You can tell her the coast is clear."
"This isn't about her," he said, slightly disoriented from the beer.
She wondered if he'd been drinking all day.
"No, it isn't," Jane agreed. "It's about us, you and me. I should have left months ago, or maybe we should never have started."
She was still convinced he had changed, but it didn't matter now. "Goodbye," she said quietly, looking at him for a last time.
"I love you, babe,"
he said, trying to put his arms around her, and she pushed him away. He didn't know the meaning of the word.
"Maybe we should try and work this out."
As far as Jane was concerned, it was way, way, way too late for that, and she was sure that Kara would be in their bed that night. It was what she had always wanted, and apparently so did he. They were kindred spirits. They were 2 users who were using each other and had lied to her. Jane didn't say another word. She just walked out and closed the door to the apartment, got in the elevator with her suitcases, and went downstairs. She dragged them through the lobby and across the sidewalk and hailed a cab. The driver put her bags in the trunk and on the front seat, and she gave him Alex's address. Jane had told her she'd be there that night. And as the cab sped downtown on the West Side Highway, she got a text from John. He was just drunk enough to have sent it to the wrong person. She was sure the message was meant for Kara, but he had sent it to her instead. All it said was, "She's gone. Come on over. Jay." He was pathetic, and she was tempted to send him a reply that said, "Fuck you." But she didn't. She erased his message and stared out the window as they drove downtown. She felt empty and numb, stupid and used. 3 years of her life had just gone up in smoke. Philip and Valerie were having dinner that night at a Thai restaurant she liked, and he found her strangely subdued.
"Are you feeling all right?"
he asked, concerned.
"Of course, I'm fine."
She smiled at him, but there was something melancholy in her eyes that he had never seen before.
"You're very quiet,"
he said, worried about her.
I'm just tired. I drove to New Hampshire and back yesterday.
You did? Why? It made no sense to him.
I went to see my old nanny, Fiona McCarthy. Do you remember her? You met her when you were about 15.
Yes, I do. She was funny. She's still alive?
Very much so, at 94. But I thought I should visit her before too long, at her age.
Why didn't you spend the night?
I wanted to come home.
You're crazy, Mom. I didn't even know you were gone.
I was fine,
she said, smiling at him, and seemed more like herself again. Have you looked at those photographs, by the way? He was referring to the ones Jane had emailed him, of Marguerite.
Yes, I have,
she said quietly. Recognize anyone you know, or some family traits? He was teasing her, and she didn't comment. She was definitely more serious than usual.
Not really, she said, and changed the subject. She was such a pretty woman. I can't wait to see the jewels at the exhibition for the show.
You can come in and look at them any time you want. I have them in the safe. We're trying to work out the estimates now. I think the prices are going to go through the roof. She nodded, but didn't say anything. They talked about his upcoming trip to Paris then, for a big Christie's sale. And he told her he was planning to go to Cartier and Van Cleef to get more information about the pieces, when they'd been purchased and for what occasions. It had taken 3 days to hear back from Cartier's archive department in Paris in answer to his inquiry. They were looking for the files on the pieces he had inquired about, and promised to get back to him in the next 2 weeks, and would be ready to show him their archives when he got to Paris. They were extremely gracious and assured him that they were making every effort to find the records and working drawings of the pieces he was interested in. And Van Cleef had said the same. Having the working drawings in the catalog will give life to the show, he explained to her.
How long will you be gone?
She asked him quietly.
A week. I have to go to London, too, and maybe Rome.
He wanted to trace the Pignelli pieces at Bulgari. He wanted to do as thorough a job of it as he could. Even if jewelry wasn't his preference, he gave the sales his all, particularly this one, which he had developed a personal interest in, and clearly his mother had too. After dinner, he walked her back to the building, and she went upstairs. She hadn't told Philip any of what she had discovered from Fiona. She wanted time to digest it, and she wasn't ready to talk about it. She had no idea what would happen when she did, or how it would affect the sale. She didn't want to upset the apple cart yet, although in time she'd have to, if she was Marguerite's heir. He took a cab back to Chelsea, and when he got back to his apartment, he thought about Jane. He still wanted to see her, but didn't know when. He didn't want to be a pest since she had a boyfriend. He had no way of knowing that at that exact moment she was sitting in her friend Alex's apartment, telling her what had happened with John. The whole thing seemed sordid and humiliating, and she wanted to put it behind her. She was surprised that she wasn't sad, just angry and relieved for now. Maybe disappointment and loneliness would come later, but not yet.
"Now you can go out with the guy from Christie's,"
Alex said after they brushed their teeth and climbed into bed. Jane's bags were standing in the hall, still packed.
"Not yet," Jane said thoughtfully. "I need some time to sort this out and get over it."
"Don't wait too long,"
Alex cautioned her, and Jane laughed.
"Good guys don't stay on the market. They get snatched up fast."
"I'm fine without a man,"
she said as much to herself as her friend. She could do anything she wanted now, and the best part of it was that she was free, and she knew she had done the right thing, leaving John. It was the best decision she'd made in years, and long overdue. Chapter 12. When Jane went to work on Monday morning, she noticed that Harriet looked exhausted and had circles under her eyes. She looked as though she'd had a rough weekend, and Jane cautiously inquired about her mother later that morning, and Harriet looked touched. As much as she had resented Jane in the beginning and assumed she was a spoiled rich girl, she had come to discover what a kind person and hard worker she was, and was growing increasingly fond of her. She had discovered that she could count on her to go the extra mile at work, and realized that she would miss her when she left. There was a freshness and energy to her that their regular employees just didn't have. She looked up at Jane with a bleak smile. My mom had a setback this weekend. Her MS seems to be getting worse at a rapid rate. I don't know if I'll be able to bring her home, and it'll kill her if I have to put her in a nursing home. Worse, Harriet had come to understand how dependent she was herself on having her mother there and having someone to take care of. They had always been very close, and the prospect of coming home to an empty apartment, living alone, and visiting her in the nursing home in the coming years depressed Harriet profoundly, and Jane could see it in her eyes.
"I'm so sorry," Jane said softly, and meant it.
Her own troubles and upsets seemed insignificant compared to Harriet's, and she felt foolish for being disappointed in John. A broken romance didn't compare to a slowly deteriorating mother, whom Harriet obviously loved.
"You look a little rocky, too," Harriet commented, having noticed Jane looking less put together than usual.
She hadn't unpacked at Alex's, and had come to work in jeans, which was rare for her.
"My boyfriend and I broke up this weekend. I moved out," she admitted, feeling sheepish about it, as though somehow it were indicative of a failure on her part for not realizing what a loser he was,
while he cheated on her and set up his business plan with Kara, financed by her dad. It made her feel stupid as much as hurt. And she'd had the same feeling when she told her mother about it the night before, who had told her she should have figured it out sooner, and she had always known the relationship wouldn't go anywhere. Jane's mother thought all relationships should lead to marriage, and told Jane that this was what she could expect if she was avoiding long-term commitment, living with men, and focusing only on her career. So she wound up with John, who only cared about his career, too. But despite what her mother said, Jane didn't feel ready for marriage, and wasn't going to be shamed or rushed into it. And Alex was right. He was the wrong guy for her. It had taken him 3 years to show his true colors, but now she knew.
"Are you heartbroken?"
Harriet asked her gently, with a sympathetic expression Jane had never seen before, and she slowly shook her head.
"Not really. Disappointed. And I feel kind of stupid. Sometimes my mother is the master of, 'I told you so.' I guess she was right."
"Then he wasn't the right guy."
"No, he wasn't,"
Jane agreed, and it was hard to admit. It was a rare exchange between them, and she could see that Harriet felt sorry for her.
"I have a project for you."
Harriet changed the subject then, as a relief for both of them.
"I thought about it this weekend. I just want to make sure we've been completely thorough in the Pignelli case. I know we didn't find a will among her documents, but I was thinking about the letters. The ones in Italian appear to have been written by someone else, but the ones in English may have been written by her. I'd like you to copy them and read through them, just to make sure we haven't missed something, the name of a relative or an heir. A letter of intent to leave the jewelry to someone, even a friend. Sometimes things turn up in old correspondence like that. Will you give them a quick read, just to be sure we checked everything?"
Jane was surprised at the request, and hadn't thought of it herself. She nodded agreement, and Harriet gave her a permission slip to get the letters out of the vault where the documents were being kept.
"I think that's a really good idea,"
Jane said enthusiastically. For all of Harriet's appearances of being bored by her job, she was good at what she did, and conscientious about it.
"There's probably nothing in them, but you never know. Stranger things have happened."
Jane went straight from Harriet's office to the vault for documents being stored, handed the slip to the woman in charge, and was given the bundle of letters a few minutes later. She went to the copy machine and made copies of all of them, and then returned the original letters to the vault. It was a thick stack of letters written in a small, old-fashioned handwriting, and she took the copies back to her desk, poured herself a cup of coffee at the office machine, and settled down to begin reading. She flipped through them before she started to see who they were addressed to, and saw that all of the salutations were similar and began with, "My beloved angel, my darling girl, or my darling child." There was no name at the beginning of any of the letters, and when she checked the signature at the end, in most cases they were signed with the initial M, and only a few were signed, "Your loving mother." It was impossible to say, before she read them, if they were written by Marguerite or to her by her mother. And they had few examples of Marguerite's handwriting to compare them to. But instinctively, Jane had the feeling that they were written by her. Not all of them had dates, but most did, and the first one was dated September 30th, 1942, and beneath the date, the author of the letters had written, "London." The first letter was addressed to my beloved angel. I still can't believe that I've left you. Unthinkable, unbearable, the most agonizing of all possible events. A tragedy for me. They took you from me, and now I am here, in London, living at a small hotel. I need to find an apartment. But where will I live? How will I live without you? How could this happen? How could they do it? I don't know if I will send you these letters one day, but if so, I must let you know how much I love you and miss you, and tell you of the agonizing hole in my heart that happened the day I left you. I have met a very nice man who has been so kind to me. He is here by special permission, on a diplomatic passport from Italy, and will only be here for a few weeks, and then he will return to Naples, where he lives. I met him the day after I arrived, when I tripped and fell in the street, and he picked me up and dusted me off, and then insisted on taking me to dinner at a very nice restaurant. He acted like a father to me, and I told him about you. I think only of you now, and wonder what you are doing, how you look, if you are healthy, and if they are being good to you. I know that Fiona will be loving to you, even if my parents are not. Please know that if they had let me stay with you, I would have. They gave me no choice. The letter went on to describe what she had done with the Italian man. Dinners, lunches, a drive to visit a friend at a manor house outside London. She wrote constantly about how kind he was to her. They had gone to the library, and in the next letter, he had found her a better place to stay and bought her a warm coat. There was something very young and innocent about the letters, as Jane read them, one after the other. Sometimes the dates were very close together. Sometimes there was a gap of weeks or even a few months. At the end of October, she said the kind man was going back to Italy and had invited her to go with him. She also said that he had asked for her hand in marriage, and she had accepted, and they were to be married shortly as soon as it was arranged. Jane couldn't tell from what she had written, somewhat demurely, if she was truly in love with him or clinging to her only friend and protector in London. There was a war on. American and British soldiers were everywhere in London, and she was totally alone. She had mentioned in the first letter that her parents had given her money to live on, so she was not without means, at least for some time, but she had been set adrift in an unfamiliar world with no contacts, friends, family, or protection at 18, and the Italian man she referred to was kind and loving, and she felt safe with him. She said that they would be married before they left for Italy, and he was taking care of everything. He was traveling on a diplomatic passport, and they would live in Naples when they went back to his home. She wrote again after the fact, spoke in somewhat vague terms about the Germans in Italy, and that her new husband had been able, with high connections, to obtain an Italian passport for her, since they were married, which she had to use now, instead of her American one, since Italy and America were at war. She mentioned traveling through Switzerland on a diplomatic train to Rome, and then to Naples. "So now I am Italian, and a countess," she said almost playfully in another letter that had begun with, "My darling angel." She said that she was happy with her new husband, who was wonderful to her. She mentioned their supplies being rationed, how much she loved his home, and that the German Oberfuhrer for the area came to visit them from time to time, and her husband felt it was wisest for them to be polite and entertain him, although they didn't agree with his point of view or his politics. In July of the following year, the Allies were bombing Rome, and she wrote how frightening that must have been for the residents of the city. And Umberto wouldn't take her to Rome anymore. A week later, in the same letter, which she continued on a different day, she spoke of the Italian government falling, and of their surrender to the Allies in September, the Germans occupying Rome again 3 days later. And in October, the Allies entered Naples, and the Italians joined the Allied forces. And they had entertained the American commanding officer in their home. She said that he had been surprised to discover that the Countess was an American. She mentioned various events of the war and bombings that continued into the following year, which was 1944. She had been in Europe and married for almost 2 years by then. As she continued to read, it was clear to Jane that the letters had in fact been written by Marguerite. And through each letter was woven the thread of how much she loved her husband, and she spoke of how much she loved and missed her darling angel. The Count had promised her that after the war they would go to New York and reclaim her. She seemed to believe it was a certainty that that would happen, and she could not wait until that day. There was a heartbreaking letter several years after that, written in 1949, which made it clear that they had gone to New York, consulted a lawyer, and attempted to reclaim the child, and had been fiercely rebuffed and attacked by Marguerite's parents. The birth certificate they had manipulated falsely for her child in 1942 when she was born would have proved difficult to discredit. They had threatened to claim that Marguerite and Umberto were Nazi sympathizers, which would not have gone well in court. And in another heart-wrenching letter, Marguerite lamented not even being able to see her when they were in New York. The lawyer they had consulted had advised them that they had no hope of reclaiming the child or even seeing her, and suggested they contact her directly when she reached 18. There was nothing more he or anyone could do. Marguerite's parents had blocked them at every turn. They had told her that everyone thought she was dead, and they wanted it to stay that way. They had buried her alive and kept her child from her. And a letter farther down the stack, written in the summer of 1960, indicated that Marguerite had tried to follow the attorney's advice, or intended to. She had gone to New York to see her daughter and tell her the real story of her birth and who her mother really was. Marguerite had followed her on the street, unseen, for several days, bowled over by how beautiful she was and how happy she looked. And she realized with an aching, broken heart that to tell her the truth would rob her of the only identity she knew, and the legitimacy she believed was hers, and would have replaced it with scandal, shame, and confusion. All Marguerite had to offer her was illegitimacy and disgrace. And in the end, Marguerite had gone back to Italy without contacting her or making herself known to her daughter. It felt wrong to her to shatter the peaceful, secure world she lived in, the respectable identity she believed was hers, and force herself on her, a mother she never knew was her own. The letters Marguerite had written after that were deeply depressed for a long time. She had lived for the opportunity to see her daughter and make contact with her, waiting patiently to do so for many years when she turned 18, only to realize that what would have been a joy for her might be a shocking tragedy to her daughter. 5 years later, she wrote of her husband's sudden death of a heart attack while he played racquetball, which left Marguerite alone in the world again, without the pillar of comfort and protection she had relied on for 23 years since she was a young girl herself. She had explained again and again over the years that having another child would have seemed like a betrayal to her, having been forced to relinquish her first one. She always said that Umberto wanted children and had none of his own, but Marguerite felt she couldn't do it. It was unthinkable to have another child while she still mourned her firstborn. And at 41, she found herself without child or husband. After that, she spoke of the difficulties of maintaining their estate after his death, the money they had spent in the years before. She spoke of his extreme generosity to her, and for the first time mentioned the many gifts of jewelry that she said she was saving for her daughter, when they would be reunited one day, which she still hoped would happen when her darling angel was older, and the truth about her birth would be less traumatic for her. And without being able to see her daughter, Marguerite never returned to the States after her fruitless visit in 1960. She sold their home in Naples in 1974, 9 years after Umberto's death, when she could simply no longer afford to keep the Castello and could no longer bear being there without him. The money she got from the sale allowed her to move to Rome, to an apartment, where she had apparently lived carefully for 20 years, until she became alarmed by her dwindling funds. She had lived frugally in Rome for all those years, having sold the horses, cars, and property. Umberto had had some other properties, which she had sold too. He had left her everything when he died. She talked about trips Umberto had taken her on, to Paris, where he had given her magnificent gifts, and throughout her letters, whenever she mentioned one of her husband's gifts to her, she declared her intention to give them to her daughter one day. But she had still been so young at the time that it probably hadn't seemed necessary to do anything serious and legal about it yet. Her letters became sadder when she got older. She wrote them less often, and seemed to have given up hope of ever meeting her only child. She mentioned that Fiona had written to her when her darling angel got married, and again, many years later, when her son was born. Marguerite was nearly 60 by then, and still living in Rome. She had no desire to visit the States, or have any contact with her family. The only person she wanted to see was her daughter, which she considered impossible by then. The letters made that clear. She was still convinced that her sudden appearance in her daughter's life, after so long, would be nearly impossible to explain, and would only disrupt her life and make her unhappy. In Marguerite's view, the moment had come and gone, and would only cause her daughter to suffer, which was the last thing she wanted, so she never contacted her, even as an adult. She believed it was too late. She wrote sadly of leaving Rome in the letters, which by now she no longer had any intention of sending to her daughter. They were a kind of diary she had kept over the years, of major events and landmarks in her life. She wrote to her daughter as though she was still a child, and when she left Rome to move back to New York, she felt as though she was leaving the only country that had been home to her. But at 70, she expressed a need to go back to her roots and believed she could live less expensively in a small apartment in New York. She spoke of that intention, and then of the apartment she had gotten, and of selling 2 pieces of jewelry, which she would be able to live off of for some time. She appeared to live a small, frugal life, careful of every penny she spent. There were no frills. Her fire seemed to have gone out by then, along with all hope of ever seeing or meeting her daughter. Her life was in the past. She spoke of Umberto often, nostalgic about the glorious years they had shared. And in one of her last letters, she said that she was going to write a will, leaving all her jewelry to her only child. She said that, with the exception of the 2 rings she had sold, she had kept all of it, as souvenirs of Umberto's love for her, and the only gift she had to leave her daughter. Her last letters became rambling, writing about the past, her bitter regrets about being forced to give up her child, the happy life she had shared with Umberto, and the deep love they had for each other. But throughout, Jane had the sense that there had always been a dark shadow over her, the absence of her child. She wrote of going to Paris with Umberto in her last 2 letters, as though they were recent trips, and Jane realized that dementia had set in by then. They were dated 4 years earlier, and her handwriting appeared to be shaky. She referred to her daughter as though she were a little girl, and wondered where she went to school. It was sad watching her decline in the letters, and sensing how lonely and alone she was. She seemed to live surrounded by her memories of people who were no longer with her. She appeared to be slowly losing her grip on life. But the one thing that was clear throughout was how much she had loved her daughter. And although she had never gotten around to writing the will she talked about for many years, it was equally clear that she had intended to leave the jewelry to her daughter as the only objects of value she had. She herself was well aware that it was no substitute for the years that had been stolen from them. She never actually mentioned her daughter by name, but it was obvious that she viewed her daughter as her only heir. And in the last letter she wrote again, for the first time in many years, about going to see her daughter, meeting her at last, and trying to explain to her what had happened, and why she had never come back or contacted her. It tormented her till the very end. There were tears rolling down Jane's cheeks when she finished the last letter. Marguerite had painted a portrait of lost love, and a mother who had been robbed of her child, and had never stopped loving her for an instant. The only open question now was who that daughter was. There was no name, nothing to go on, no clue as to who or where she was. And given the age of her daughter, it was possible that her only heir might no longer even be alive. Jane went back to Harriet's office at the end of the day with a heavy heart. "Find anything?" Harriet asked her expectantly. She was hoping for a handwritten will slipped between the pages of the letters that had previously gone unnoticed.
"Lots," Jane said sadly. "I think she had a daughter she gave up at 18 before she left for Europe. She never saw her again. She tried to regain custody of her 7 years later, and her parents stopped her. There was something about a falsified birth certificate that named Marguerite's parents as the child's parents. She was going to contact her at 18 and went to New York to see her, and changed her mind, afraid to disrupt the daughter's life. She never saw her again, or tried to contact her. She makes it clear that she saved the jewelry for her, and intended to write a will to that effect, but she never did." The dementia had already set in at the end of the letters. She was in her late 80s by then. "I have no idea who the daughter is. She's never named in the letters, and I don't know where she is. She may not even live in New York anymore, or she could be dead. She would be in her 70s now herself. The story is just so sad. There's a whole life in those letters, but nothing we can use to find her only heir."
Let's just hope she saw one of our notices and contacts us. But it seemed unlikely to both of them. The trail was cold, and the child Marguerite Pearson had given up and referred to for more than 70 years as her darling angel was impossible to find without a name. It was all Jane could think of as she took the subway to Alex's apartment that night after work. Alex had a date, and Jane was going to work on her final paper that she still needed to finish for graduation. But the words "darling angel" kept dancing in front of her eyes as she sat at her computer screen. Jane couldn't imagine anything more painful